Good evening. A couple of announcements. One is that I'll be in New Mexico next week celebrating Buddha's birthday. And Donna Lynn is going to celebrate Buddha's birthday here. So if some of you haven't had that experience, please come. You get to pour sweet tea on the baby Buddha and send profound and loving wishes for the welfare of the world. You can bring kids, if you know kids, bring children. And it's a kind of birthday party, but also a celebration. In most Buddhist traditions, it's the birth and death and enlightenment are all celebrated in one fell swoop, usually in May. But in our tradition, in the Zen tradition, we celebrate the death in February and the birth in April, April 8th, and the enlightenment on December 8th. So we have it all spread out through the year. And usually there's a sesshin that goes along with it. And there's a sesshin at Jikoji this next week. And if you have a chance to just go up even for a couple of hours, it's a wonderful opportunity to, one, to sit in a sesshin environment, which is the best, and two, to meet Ian Forsberg, who is coming out from New Mexico to lead the sesshin at Jikoji. So we're passing each other in the air, I think. We'll have to wave out the airplane window. He's a wonderful teacher. He's one of Koban's students. And very vital and wonderful and charming teacher. Bodhisattva, I want to say. And then the very next Tuesday, Vanya's coming. So Vanya is my teacher after Koban. He lives in Switzerland. He's the one who created Felsentor, the beautiful big sort of hotel and gorgeous Zen temple up in the mountains outside of Lucerne. And every now and then he drops in, and he's going to be coming on Tuesday night. So please remember that and come if you can. He is also a very wonderful guy, Bodhisattva. And then I have flyers here for the writing retreat. If anyone, it's for women only, alas. In a way, it's too bad. It's so much fun. It's a shame that it's so exclusive. But it's an opportunity, if you would like. These are the flyers. Any questions about that? Any of that?
Next week for the Buddha's birthday ceremony, will we have a regular?
I think what we usually do is sit for the regular time, and then maybe even do the service, and then do the Buddha's birthday. I haven't talked to Donna Lynn about it, but she did it last year, I believe. So I think she has a better grasp of it than I do. The reason for the sweet tea is because the story of Buddha's birth is that the gods rained down sweet dew to wash the baby off. So that's why we get to pour the sweet tea on him. Welcome the baby and clean him up for his life on earth. It's a myth. But for springtime, it's a very fresh and beautiful story. On 17, 18, and 19, the verses are not numbered. I've numbered them so that each one in this book is written out just one sentence, and then the Musong, the one who is writing the commentary, writes a long commentary, and then the next sentence comes along. And the only way that I can talk about it is to number them so that I can refer to them. So if you want to, you can number them also, and then you'll know where we are. But it's not so necessary. I'm doing them about three at a time. And these three seem, 17, 18, and 19, just seem to hang together rather well. 17 goes, to return to the root is to find the meaning, but to pursue appearances is to miss the source. Pursuing appearances is mostly how we manage our lives. It's how we know how things are. We know that they're red or green, or they're good or bad, or they're healthy or not healthy. We're always discriminating how things are, and we begin to believe that that's really how they are. We forget how unsolid things actually are, and give meaning in a way that is just an idea. I have thought about this a great deal because I went through a period just recently of something like this, where how can I say? Well, there was a time way in the early years of Jikoji, so it must have been about 20 years ago. I, with a group of friends, spent a weekend at Jikoji in a kind of retreat, and each of us brought something to put on the altar that had special meaning for us. Somebody brought her grandmother's picture, somebody brought a flower, and I brought my teaching stick and my writing pen and put them both on the altar, because I felt a tremendous conflict in my life between being engaged, deeply engaged in Zen at Jikoji at that time, and being a writer. Being a writer. Already, that there's something funny about that. And all through the years, it's been a puzzle for me, a kind of koan. How do I do this? This is two kinds of way to be. And recently, I've been, since that little book was published, I really feel blindsided by that. I was just so, I'm still so surprised by it. And it made the writer be so real. So real, the writer so real. The writer. And then I thought, well, who is the priest? So then we're back again. Here's the priest and here's the writer. Here's the teaching stick and here's the pen. And all of a sudden I thought, well, that's really stupid. It's just me. It's not those things. It was a false problem in the first place, in the sense of imbuing deep meaning into those titles and those roles. They're just roles. we play many, many roles. We appear in many ways. When we go to a party, we appear in party clothes, and then we are a party being. When we play the piano, we're a piano-playing being. When we are eating supper, we're a supper-eating person. That's what he's talking about. That if we imbue deep meaning and reality to the roles that we play, the appearances that we present to ourselves first, and then to the world, we get confused. He quotes his teacher, his Korean teacher, Sung San, who said, human beings have no meaning. They have no reason. And then he says, this is the terrifying aspect of the wisdom of shunyata. So if you really get it, that really we have no meaning besides the various appearances that come and go, that it's hard to take unless, and he goes on, we are aware of the great meaning, capital G, capital M, meaning how big we are, how huge this whole dynamic working of things is, in which we are, of which we are a part. So he says what it comes down to is the bodhisattva wisdom by itself doesn't work very well. It is wise to remember that words are just words and roles are just roles and meaning is transient, and yet also very helpful to remember that we're here with everyone. And that's the bodhisattva way, that we recognize that we're here with everyone, living all together, and how hard it is for people. And so with the wisdom that we have, we vow to help out wherever we can. Even if it just means listening, or just sitting quietly with someone. So the next one continues with this theme and says, at the moment of inner enlightenment, there is going beyond appearance and emptiness. So this is the bodhisattva way. And going beyond appearance and emptiness means just responding to the moment. There's that story that Dogen tells, an older story than Dogen, about what is the bodhisattva practice of compassion. And the answer is, it's like someone turning over in their sleep and reaching for a pillow. It's not that we go out girded with, you know, our power and bless everything and make it all better. It's just that we respond moment by moment as we can to whatever needs to be done. It's not very glamorous, really. And yet, it creates a world so different. There was a time when everybody was very aware of littering, and if anybody dropped something out of the car window, it was an abomination. Everybody was horrified by it. And the streets were clean. It's hard to believe now. And it made such a difference in the feeling of the whole area, the whole Bay Area. And now it's trashy. People don't know how to care anymore. And that's just one little small thing. It doesn't take a lot of thought. It doesn't take a lot of glorious intention. It's just whether to make that little difference. So that's what this is about. It's not a big deal, but it's a lot of little deals. And then he goes on, Lu Song goes on about this one, about inner enlightenment. That is, he says, that the separate self, the self that we think is me, is shattered. He compares that with something that Ken Wilber describes as a transformed self, the self that studies another language or learns different manners or lives in a different town and has a different culture, that ourselves change in many kind of ways, transforming as we get older, just from childhood all the way through. Those are all transformations of self. And we can document that. It's kind of interesting to look back at all the many selves that we were and wonder about the ones we're going to become that we don't know yet. But he said that the shattered self is changed, that it goes beyond appearances and no longer identifies with whatever the appearances are. Whichever transformation, just be that. So it's really about simple being rather than the more complicated kinds of ways that we make up for ourselves, trying to figure out who we are. We don't really know, except in the moment. And in the moment, we're just being that. And then we look back and say, oh, did I say that? Did I do that? I think shattered is a kind of melodramatic word, frankly. It seems like it's a moment by moment work that we do, as bodhisattva work. So the last sentence, number 19, is, the changes that appear to occur in the empty world we call real only because of our ignorance. And empty means not empty like there's no air, or it's all air. It means empty of being, own being, empty of being a self. It's a complicated, sounds like a complicated idea, though it's very simple. That little chest is empty because it can be taken all apart. And then it will be many different things. It will be pieces of this and pieces of that that can then be assembled in a whole different way and be a whole different thing. And everything in the world is empty in that way. You take the chair apart, and you'll have firewood, perhaps. You could call it firewood. Or throw a piece of it to a dog, and it'd be a toy for a dog. Or make something else out of it. So nothing stays put. Nothing is fixed, except in a temporary way. These chairs have been around for a long time. They're very old and much mended chairs. They're very beautiful. But they're not forever. And it came from a tree, and the tree came from a seed, and the seed came from etc., etc., etc. So everything that appears as a thing depends, its appearance depends on many, many jillions of things coming together to create this thing, this being. We too. Stephen Batchelor said in one of his talks that his mother told him when he was about 12 years old, they were looking through old photographs, and she pointed to a man in uniform, and she said, "That man would have been your father if he hadn't been killed in the war." He said, "No, he would have been my father, but would I have been me?" He said that's when he started realizing how things are, how dependent everything is on everything else. And our lives are like that too. If our parents had come together 5 minutes before or 5 minutes after, we wouldn't be here. Somebody else would. Isn't that weird? It's incredible, really. And if the house burned down next door, maybe we wouldn't be around at all. So so really, it's about letting go. Being willing to not hold so tightly that we our thinking and our lives become narrow. If we're to define things too carefully and too well and expect them to stay the same, it becomes a very, very small life. And the closer the walls are to us, the more we are bumping into them, trying to figure out how to make more space. So letting go of our ideas about appearance is a way to create a much bigger field for our mind and our life. Is there questions and comments?
About shattered self, that's the word he used. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, it doesn't mean like you pick up a piece of glass and throw it down on the ground and it goes boom and shoots off in infinite directions. It's more to me maybe another way of thinking of it. I'm stealing this idea sort of from something I read by Tadagiri in one of his books. When he's talking about time, he kind of just keeps slowing it down and slowing it down to the point where the interval between the moments becomes so small that it's infinitely non-existent. And, yeah. And that, in that sense, then ourself is just a very temporary construct, you know, it always changing every tiny instant. So,
yeah.
In that sense, it's not really shattered, but it's kind of a, so transient that it might just as well be.
That's why those teachings about getting rid of the ego are misleading, because it's assuming there is an ego, or assuming there really is a self that can be got rid of. And you look around and you really can't find a self.
He needs to go to the Zen women's to learn how to pick his birth cover. No, just kidding.
Anything else? Samuel?
I want to share something kind of funny. We have a puppy. Uh-huh. We're taking it to puppy preschool.
Oh, yes.
And this is the third week, and the puppies play together at the beginning. They go crazy and wild, and all the parents sit back, and there's three teachers kind of break up the fights. And my puppy's been getting A's for a while, and last week she got detention three times because jumping all over the puppy. So the third week we learned about timeout. Mm-hmm. So whenever she sees that, you know, she's just playing a little rough, the teacher will come and take it. We didn't know what she was doing, and take it and just face the wall.
Amazing.
Everything is fine after that. And then I said, okay, now I see the purpose for my dog.
Does Maya see that too?
Yeah.
That's great. That's great.
That's the new thing this week, is time out, you face the wall. And then observe. Things are a little calmer.
Makes a difference.
Yeah. You know, you forget what you were all wound up about.
That's right. That's right. Every time.
She's just having to face the white wall. I said, okay. That's what Angie says.